Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The first official clinical definition of post-COVID sickness has been issued in a bid to improve treatment for sufferers, the UN World Health Organization said on Friday. The emerging illness, which is also referred to as long COVID, occurs in people who have had confirmed or probable new coronavirus infections, usually around 3 months after the onset of COVID-19. Symptoms include fatigue, shortness of breath and brain fog, and can last for at least 2 months. They cannot be explained by an alternative diagnosis, said Dr. Janet Diaz, head of clinical management at WHO.
This is an important step forward to standardize the recognition of patients living with post-COVID-19 condition. We hope it will help clinicians and health workers recognize patients and start them on appropriate treatments and interventions and care pathways. We hope that policymakers and health systems will set up and implement integrated care models to care for these patients.
Until now, a lack of clarity among healthcare professionals about the condition has complicated efforts in advancing research and treatment, WHO said. The UN agency noted that most patients who suffer from COVID-19 fully recover, although some suffer long-term effects on several body systems, including pulmonary, cardiovascular and nervous system, as well as psychological effects. In Myanmar, concerns are growing about an imminent attack on several townships where residents are believed to be sympathetic to those fighting the military junta who took control of the country in February. In an alert on Friday, the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, said that the state military known as the Tatmadaw had sent reinforcements to townships in Chin State in the central Sagaing region and in Magway. Here's spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani speaking in Geneva.
There are already killings of civilians, burning of villages, use of heavy artillery in civilian and residential areas by the Tatmadaw. What has happened now, over the past few days, we've seen a real reinforcement, a substantial deployment of heavy weapons and troops.
Since the military coup on the 1st of February, 1,120 people are believed to have been killed resisting the new regime, Ms. Shamdasani said, citing reliable reports. She explained that the situation inside Myanmar had deteriorated since the 7th of September when the opposition National Unity Government declared war on the military junta. Torture and summary executions have been reported, along with military clearance operations that have involved the use of artillery barrages and airstrikes against villages. Mass detentions have increased too, with nearly 450 people held in just the last month, along with regular internet blackouts, the UN Rights Office spokesperson continued. To the 2021 Nobel Peace Prize now, which has been awarded to journalists Maria Ressa and Dmitry Muratov for their campaigning journalism. In a statement, the Norwegian Nobel Committee applauded Ms. Ressa from the Philippines and Mr. Muratov from Russia for safeguarding freedom of expression, which is a precondition for democracy and lasting peace. Joining in messages of congratulation, Ravina Shamdasani from the UN Rights Office said that the award was recognition for journalists who work in the most difficult circumstances. Recent years have seen an increase of attacks against journalists, and Ms. Ressa, who is based in the Philippines, has used her work to expose abuse of power, use of violence, and growing authoritarianism there, and the so-called war on drugs, the Nobel panel said. It also noted that Mr. Muratov from Russia had defended freedom of speech there for decades under increasingly challenging conditions, as editor-in-chief of the Novaya Gazeta newspaper, described by the Nobel Committee as an important source of information on censurable aspects of Russian society rarely mentioned by other media. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Hello. In this week's show, a UN-led push to get more COVID vaccines into lots more arms all over the world, Afghanistan breaches the depths of destitution, and an alert in northern Mozambique over the indoctrination of children by insurgents. Plus, the latest on the situation inside Syria from Paulo Pinheiro, chair of the UN-appointed International Commission of Inquiry on Syria, which reports to the Human Rights Council. That's all coming up in this week's UN Catch-Up, Dateline Geneva. Thanks for listening. First, the news. With Katie Dartford.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A new UN-led global initiative launched on Thursday to get more COVID-19 vaccines into countries where coverage is far behind richer nations is a way out of the pandemic for everyone, everywhere. This was the message from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres as he lent his support to the World Health Organization-backed campaign. Its target is to get vaccines into the arms of 40% of people in all countries by the end of 2021 and 70% by the middle of next year. The goal is possible as global vaccine production is now at nearly 1.5 billion doses per month, but reaching 4 in 10 people in all countries by the year's end will depend on being able to mobilize $8 billion to ensure that distribution is done equitably. Mr. Guterres described the plan as a costed, coordinated and credible path out of the coronavirus crisis. It was an alternative to vaccine nationalism, vaccine hoarding and vaccine diplomacy, the UN Secretary General insisted. Life-saving aid distributions to millions in Afghanistan have been scaled up, but much more is needed before winter comes, UN humanitarians said on Wednesday. 3 weeks since a major international appeal for funds to help nearly 11 million of the most vulnerable by the end of the year, only around a third of what's required has been received, said UN Humanitarian Coordinating Office OCHA. Supporting the call for urgent assistance, the head of the World Food Programme in Afghanistan, Mary Ellen McGroty, said that Afghanistan was on borrowed time. In my long career with WFP, I've never before seen a crisis unfold at this pace and scale, she said, adding that Afghans faced a new depth of destitution as drought and the economic crisis drives up food and fuel prices. In northern Mozambique, worrying reports have emerged that children as young as 5 have been shown how to handle weapons and indoctrinated to fight with insurgents. The warning on Tuesday from UN Children's Fund UNICEF came as aid access improved to previously inaccessible areas in Cabo Delgado province that were occupied by Al-Shabaab militia. When fighting broke out in March, humanitarian access to the district was completely blocked and to tens of thousands of displaced people, including those who had fled the coastal town of Parma. It was only very recently that UNICEF and partners managed to deliver hygiene kits, water purification tablets, food and shelter to the displaced population in Parma with the help of the Mozambican authorities. Here's the agency's spokesperson in Geneva, James Elder.
Unverified video material secured by armed forces in an abandoned training camp apparently shows abducted children, some as young as 5, handling weapons and being indoctrinated to fight. This unfortunately is leaving very little doubt that children are being forcibly recruited by this non-state armed group.
Katie Dartford, UN News.
Thanks, Katie. And now to this week's interview with Paulo Pinheiro, head of the Commission of Inquiry on Syria. After more than 10 years of war, many parts of this beautiful Mediterranean country are a shell. Its people have been wrecked psychologically, physically, and economically. The task of reporting on the rights violations that have happened and which continue to happen in the country is the job of the Commission of Inquiry. The three commissioners who lead investigations have just reported back to the Human Rights Council in Geneva. One of their main findings is that today, although President Bashar al-Assad controls about 70% of the territory and 40% of the pre-war population, there seems to be no moves to unite the country or to seek meaningful reconciliation. With more on this, let's hear from Commission Chair Paulo Pinheiro, who I spoke to in Geneva via Zoom.
The main message of this report, that despite the bombardments and the airstrikes that were happening during all those years on the territory of Syria have diminished, this doesn't mean that the war against the civilians in terms of human rights violations, the humanitarian crimes, the arbitrary detention, they continue. Then we expected that when the government would control 2/3 of the territory, the government will be interested in establishing peace among its population, but that is not the case. And I think this is the central message of the report. Syria is not yet dignified place for the return of the millions of refugees.
It's your suggestion that there is discontent even among the most loyal communities in the countries, and those have led to protests. How has the government been trying to deal with these protests, which are caused really by economic deterioration in the country?
First, it's very important to say that there are other actors contributing for this war against the Syrian people. that are the terrorist organizations and the non-state armed groups that do and indiscriminate bombardments, for instance, attacks and bombs in the three areas that violence is concentrated. In the last three reports, we decided to devote a lot of attention to the real situation of the people living inside Syria. And even if we have not access to the territory, we're able to become aware of several protests precisely against difficulties in the everyday life in terms of the economy in a very bleak situation, the situation of water, electricity, everything aggravated by the destruction of the main cities in the country. It's very difficult to survive in Syria in this sort of post-conflict situation.
And you've spoken about sieges being used once again as a tactic of war, which of course is a war crime. Where have these sieges been taking place and why?
Yeah, we have seen sieges in areas in the northwest, sometimes perhaps as a conclusion of the evaluations that is not interesting to use the army, and then there is a return to this kind of medieval tactics, that is, you encircle a village and then you forbid the circulation of food, of medicines. Happily, these have been not so long sieges as we described in the past, but in any way, it is very worrisome that this practice of sieges have returned at this very moment.
You have spoken about the armed groups around Syria. You've talked about targeted assassinations and the use of improvised explosive devices, which I think in your report you say happen really quite a lot. So it must be absolutely terrifying to be even contemplating going out to the market in Syria at the moment. Maybe you could just paint a picture of the daily struggle inside the country.
It's really very difficult to live in Syria because from one side, you have the continuation of the practice by the government in terms of arbitrary detention. You never know when you will be able to pass a checkpoint without being detained. And the danger is also for the people who dare to return and they are detained because they have problems with the military service. Then you have the violations of practice by the government. But on the other hand, you have the indiscriminate attacks by armed groups, the most important HTS acting in the northwest, in Idlib, where you have these devices that perpetrate a terrible situation in the population. That is a population that is living under fear despite the reduction of the hostilities. It's very hard to continue with a normal life in Syria as it was possible before the war.
Let's move quickly on then, if we can, to COVID and what your latest understanding of the situation is, given that hospitals have been targeted in the past and public infrastructure is in many places totally destroyed.
What we are seeing in Syria is very much in many countries in the south that are not in war. The situation has been aggravated precisely because of the destruction of the health structure that before the war was very positive in Syria, and also the access to the vaccine. Syria is having access mainly to COVAX, but is, of course, it's not sufficient to deal. And then we have sort of 1% of the population that have been vaccinated against the pandemic.
Thank you. And very last question to you. The ongoing uncertainty over Al-Hol and the misery for so many children there of former ISIL fighters and ISIL families, or so-called ISIL families, what's the latest there? And you had some very strong words for member states who still won't take children home.
For the last 30 months, we are seeing thousands of children so young as 6 years or 8 years old that continue in institutions, in different institutions in the Al-Hol camp. And we have invoked many times the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And we are seeing countries that abide to this convention being unable to liberate these children. The children cannot pay for the sins of their parents. This is an absurd. But this is exactly what is happening. Democratic countries that abide to the principles of the Convention of the Rights of the Child are not respecting these principles in dealing with those children in prison. I think this is one of the most scandalous features of the present situation, the present war against the Syrian people in Syria.
My thanks to Paolo Pinheiro for the latest on the situation in Syria. For more detail on the Commission's findings, you can read its report on the UN Human Rights Office website now. It's ohchr.org. And now it's time to welcome back Solange Beautegui-Cortez, who joins us on the line for some closing comments. Hi, Solange.
Hola, Daniel. During the COVID pandemic, we have often heard the desire to go back to normal. But what is normal here is not normal there. Paulo Pinheiro asked something that made me think, how to have a normal life in Syria? In her book, Lend Me a Window, the poet and documentary filmmaker Hala Mohammad, who fled Syria in 2011, talks about her Syria, where bombs destroy houses, windows. How to live in a country without windows? For Hala Mohammad, bombs cannot destroy art and culture. Poetry is writing silence, she said, which I think could also mean that poetry is the act of breaking the silence. In her poetry, Hala writes, once upon a time, not so very long ago, there was a people known, the Syrian people. They lived in a country called Syria, which bordered the Mediterranean, facing the rising sun. It was here that the first alphabet was created. The rhythm of its civilization was a mosaic of languages, religions, and tribes that permitted the country shaping its geography and its history. Like many of her fellow Syrians, Hala Mohammad is armed with nothing but words. As long as they live, they will not stop telling their tale. With images, photos and films, poems, novels, songs and music, paintings and theater, they are fighting to nurture a culture of life that's stronger than the culture of murder. For those who are forced to live on the run, for the displaced, for the arbitrarily detained, poetry is their voice. Poetry is also a window on people's history. As Hala says, all I want when I return is to find the path, the pavement, the old house, and that the tree remembers me. Lend me a window.
Thank you, Solange. Yes, it is a bleak picture, but the decade-old conflict is not forgotten by any means. Thanks to Paolo Pinheiro and the other members of the Commission of Inquiry that reports to the Human Rights Council, Karen Koenig Abu Zaid and Hani Megali, who we've spoken to on this show before. It's time to wrap things up, so we'd better do that. My thanks to you, Solange, for your comments, as ever, to Katie Dartford for being with us today also, and thank you, listeners, for making time for the show and following the UN's work. Don't forget, if you want more headlines, stories and interviews, just check out UN News. We'll be back next week with my first interview with a giant puppet that's been walking from Syria to Manchester to highlight the plight of refugees from that conflict. Until then, look after yourselves. Bye-bye for now.
Ciao, Daniel. Nos vemos la próxima semana.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A new UN-led global initiative launched on Thursday to get more COVID-19 vaccines into countries where coverage is far behind richer nations is a way out of the pandemic for everyone everywhere. That was the message from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres as he lent his support to the World Health Organization campaign. Its target is to get vaccines into the arms of 40% of people in all countries by the end of 2021 and 70% by the middle of next year. This goal is possible as global vaccine production is now at nearly 1.5 billion doses per month, but reaching 4 in 10 people in all countries by the year's end will depend on being able to mobilise $8 billion to ensure that distribution is done equitably. Mr. Guterres described the plan as a costed, coordinated and credible path out of the coronavirus crisis. It was an alternative to vaccine nationalism, vaccine hoarding and vaccine diplomacy, he said. Staying with the UN Secretary General, who has said that the humanitarian situation in northern Ethiopia is paralyzed, with fuel, medicine and other essential relief items blocked. Briefing the Security Council on Wednesday night, Antonio Guterres said deliveries of life-saving aid to Tigray were still nowhere near the level required, which is 100 trucks per day. Aid teams on the ground in the war-torn province have reported increasingly alarming testimonies of suffering and deaths from hunger, the UN chief said. This latest assessment indicates that more than 5 million people need emergency assistance in Tigray, 400,000 of whom are in near famine-like conditions. Another 2 million need help in neighbouring Amhara, where fighting is complicating the work of humanitarians, and Afar, which provides the only road link to Tigray, and where convoys are severely restricted by official and non-official checkpoints, insecurity and other challenges, Mr. Guterres explained. Food prices across the world last month were almost 33% higher than in September 2020, according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. In its latest food price index released on Thursday, the FAO found that prices rose over 1% from August, owing to tightening supply conditions and strong demand for staple foods such as wheat and palm oil. The price of cereals increased by 2% in September, with wheat up as much as 41% compared to a year earlier. Vegetable oil prices were also up 1.7% from August and about 60% from September 2020, while dairy prices increased by 1.5% from last month. Sugar prices were 0.5% higher and over 53% up from a year earlier. Meat prices were virtually unchanged in September from the previous month and up over 26% from the past year. According to another FAO report released on Thursday, world cereal output is on course to hit an all-time record of 2,800 million tonnes over the next year. But this is less than anticipated demand owing to the expected significant increase in the use of wheat for livestock feed. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Hi, I'm Mamadou Jai, but you might know me as the Animal Guy on TikTok at MJai_97. And if you already knew that, you're probably used to hearing me talk about the weird, the funny, and the slightly disturbing facts of nature. You know, like the animals that might look harmless but will legitimately mess you up, and the animals that look like a menace to society but are actually pretty chill. But I think we can all agree the real threat to mankind and literally every other animal on the planet is climate change. This is No Denying It, the United Nations Climate Action Podcast. In 2020, the UN Secretary General said that the youth of today are showing the world what leadership on climate action looks like, and that they're on the front lines of the fight. One of those climate front lines is actually in this ordinary-looking office.
So, one person starts moving, and then we all...
At first glance, it doesn't look like anything special. There's some people standing around awkwardly, and the chairs have all been rolled off to the sides of the room. Everyone in this room is young. Some have their arms crossed over their chest and some are giggling, but you can tell it's nervous giggling. It's like they know what's coming and they're already embarrassed. They're being led in an icebreaker, and we all know how much we love those. The instructor tells them to move a certain way, so they start to shuffle around the room. They're following one another, but trying not to bump into each other. But like the awkward icebreakers we've all had to go through, it's only to get the group's energy flowing, and eventually the nervous giggling does become actual laughter. Everyone starts to relax, and you can tell people are becoming less self-conscious and insecure around each other. And it might not seem like much, but in the fight to help young people stay hopeful about the climate, this is very much a win. It's a win because the connections they make with each other today will help them build solutions to climate change tomorrow. These folks are participants in Young Climate Leaders, or YCL, founded in Brazil in 2018. The program works with young, hopeful people who might not be able to afford university and help them build a climate career. YCL runs workshops on leadership skills, and they educate participants on the science of climate change. They also host visits to key locations so they can see the process combating climate change up close. Locations like, for example, Paris.
Ymana, why are you so excited?
Hi, because the Eiffel Tower is brillando.
Oh, wait, the tower brillando.
It's so romantic.
YCL also gives the participants a chance to just hang out and get to know each other, because that's a pretty big part of Young Climate Leaders, too.
We are out at the Eiffel Tower, and we had now climate change today.
The goal is to create a network of people who can support each other while also working together on big climate challenges, like stopping deforestation in the Amazon or reducing agricultural emissions. YCL was first started in Brazil to help support young people living in places facing unique issues like income equality, which often tie in with the fight against climate change. But across the world, there's one big challenge that every young person who cares about the climate is currently dealing with.
There's a journalist in Brazil, Eliane Brum, that I really like the concept that she brought, that we are seeing with Greta and all these young climate activists, the first generation without hope.
This is Cassio Moraes, one of the founders of YCL, and she sees the problem of a generation without hope up close in the program.
So what we see is young people from the first time in several centuries that they don't believe that their life will be better than their father's.
And it can be depressing for young people to have to deal with the stress of both finding work and the constant bad news regarding our planet's future. But it seems like almost every time you turn on the TV and hear something about our planet, it's almost invariably negative.
But if you know how serious and real climate change is as a problem, but at the same time that someone is helping you to understand how and what to do, this burden can be softened. So that's what we try to do in a nutshell.
Everyone helping out to carry the burden. That is what Cassio Moraes has set out to do. She spoke with our producer, Rachel Ward.
What drew you into climate change? Was there a moment when you decided you wanted that to be your work?
I took an unusual path when I was 14 years old. I decided to stop eating meat. So I think that was my kind of wake-up call. And that made me more aware about environmental impacts, and I started meeting people that were working in the field. I believe that these two things, having stopped eating meat and thinking about environmental issues, the animals, combined with studying international relations and seeing how much the topic was growing, made me realize that I could combine the two things, work on climate change, having an international career at the same time, which was not very common back then.
What made you stop eating meat?
Back then was more because of the animals, was not because of the environment. And it was way more difficult. Brazil is built on a barbecue culture. So it was something that made me feel lonely in the beginning. And also, I believe, made me look for more environmental activist friends and people that could understand at least what I was trying to do with that.
What is the general, I mean, this is a big generalization to ask you to make, but like, what is the thinking around climate change in Brazil? How do people talk about it or approach it?
That's a very good question. In Brazil, climate change is not considered a priority compared to other countries, but it's also because there are so many urgent things. Ordinary Brazilian, like someone that is living their life, like you can be facing poverty, you can be facing unemployment, violence. Brazil is a very violent country, many deaths because of police confrontation and so forth. So I believe up to now, climate change is not being like the main topics that Brazilians discuss in their daily lives. On the other hand, even though we are seeing a more resistance from our national government, Brazilians in general, they are less prone to climate denials, such as you can see in the U.S. And that's one of the things that when we created Youth Climate Leaders, we believe that tackling climate change can also make a better those other challenges that Brazilians have, such as unemployment and violence and education. And differently from Europe, most of the young people in Brazil, they cannot be full-time activists. So I think this is one challenge as well. A lot of people will say that young people in Brazil are not as active on climate change as Europeans or even Americans. But the fact is that most of young people in the country, they cannot be full-time activists. So the way that we are trying to empower youth in Brazil and other developing countries is to help them turn climate activism into their careers so that they can also have income, pay their bills, and help their families, which is something that most young people in developing countries have to do. And a lot of young people were asking me how they could get their foot on the door and start their careers on climate change. I realized that we could try to do something, to create an organization that would make this pathway way easier and fast so we could catalyze climate careers. And what took me 5 to 7 years would take them 6 months or less, and they would finally start their career on climate change as well.
I'm wondering, when you talk about climate jobs, that's a huge bucket of types of jobs, but I wonder if you could describe some of the work that young people, like entry-level jobs that you guys are trying to get your participants to access.
Sure. For example, we have several jobs that are related to consultancies for governments and companies, and to help them account the greenhouse gas emissions, very technical stuff, or policymaking or politics, organizations working in the energy sector that are looking for us to help them to hire for technical jobs. So we can talk to young people that are doing studying those technical schools. They don't even have to go for like university. They can have a very solid career plan. There are tons of jobs related to communications. Every NGO, every company has a communication part of it. And finally, we had a lot of people either working at or are interested in a sustainable diets, part of climate change. So we have vegan chefs, we have people working in organizations that incubate vegan alternatives, and even nutritionists. So that's interesting to see that there's no like a profession so far that came to us that we said, you don't have a place on the transition to a climate resilient society. So that's very interesting to see that everyone can do something.
Yeah, that's really encouraging that companies are starting to think about their climate impact across sort of like every sector. The strategy that you guys have deployed was to start youth climate leaders in Brazil and then have moved sort of from there. Can you talk a little bit about the choice to do that?
First of all, like the four co-founders are Brazilian women. So that's where we came from and where our network is, at least most of it. Also, we consider that Brazil is a very important country for climate action, and it doesn't take as much attention as other countries, and also as a developing country or emerging country, we had needs that are different from European countries or the U.S. that we have to account for. And we realized from the very beginning, although we started in Brazil, we started with international immersion in Paris and in Kenya, and we received 500 applications from 95 countries. And most were coming from developing countries because we believe that our strategy, our approach touches those young people because we try to help them to secure a climate career, to better their life. And there is this concept, the entrepreneurship of scarcity.
Entrepreneurship of scarcity.
Yes, we kind of know when we are in the developing country that we're not going to develop apps for things that nobody needs. Like, we have real problems to solve. And the mindset of young people in Brazil, in Kenya, in other places that we've been, is different in the way that they can bring a kind of a reality check to the climate movement. And most of youth-led organizations are created by young people in Europe or the U.S., and they don't have sometimes the same needs of young people from developing countries. So that's why we believe that it's so important to have our roots in a country like Brazil. And finally, also because Brazil is huge. We have, like, if we talk about youth there, we have people on our network coming from indigenous communities, from urban areas, from the northeast of Brazil. So there's a lot of creativity. But on the other hand, because of several reasons, including political ones, it's more difficult to grow an organization in Brazil only if you want to be global. So we realized that at some point we would need to build a headquarters in a different country or continent so that we could have access to funding and other things that in Brazil, unfortunately, right now, it's not that possible.
You mentioned that youth in Brazil have a particular set of needs. Could you talk a little bit about that?
For example, we see very bright people in our network that didn't have the opportunity to study English or even to go to university. Oftentimes, this make very difficult their path they will face now the pandemic, and it's very common for young people in the country to support the families from a very early age with their wages. They cannot afford to get a sabbatical or a gap year, as is common in Europe and the U.S. Oftentimes, they are responsible for a significant amount of their family income. So this is something that we have to consider. And finally, because of all this social inequality and things that we see, we tend to notice that young people from our network in Brazil, they are building solutions that will also account for those social inequalities. There's a lot of sexism in Brazil, so like women empowerment is very important on our activities and the projects that the members of our network are building. But in the case of Brazil, it's not only the transition to carbon neutral in mid-century. We have to also take millions of people out of poverty while we make our country more just and safe for many people.
You said that climate change in Brazil, or the issue of climate in Brazil, is a little bit different than it is in other places. Can you describe what some of the challenges that Brazil has are?
I think just to begin with, like our emissions, they are different from most countries where energy is often the main cause of emissions. In our case, most of it comes from forestation followed by agriculture. For example, in the case of deforestation, if you are a young person in São Paulo, in Rio, how can you curb deforestation in the Amazon? There's a lot of regulatory issues that goes oftentimes out of your hands. The same thing about agriculture is not something that most of people, if they are not farmers, they feel related to. So a lot of things need to change. And what we try to do is to show practical ways of how they can do this through changing the political landscapes and also supporting local regional governments, policies that will help them to change the scenario. And those emissions are making very few Brazilians rich. And on the other hand, if we talk about the transition to low carbon economies, there is a potential to generate more jobs and other things. So, for example, a study from the World Resources Institute, it's called A New Economy to a New Age, shows that if we implement today the low carbon policies we need, this can result in 2 million more jobs than the business as usual scenario. So the fact is that we can generate more wealth and distribute this better through this transition than just keeping with activities that are not making our population rich, but very few people.
I want to talk a little bit about the learning journeys that you do with your participants. What does the curriculum look like to help move from the place of wanting to have a climate career, but not quite knowing how to like get into it?
For example, in the case of the YCL course, which is the major learning journey that we have right now, we have a combination of a curriculum that starts with a lot of self-knowledge activities combined with project development. And then we go to topics that are emerging topics, such as leadership and the future of work. And we talk about climate science. It's very important that they know the minimum so that they can have, no matter which sector or job they would choose, that's the minimum that they should know to advance. We talk about politics, topics such as circular economy, the link of climate change and the other sustainable development goals, the energetic transition, both in Brazil but also globally, land use change and forest, the Amazon, and topics such as finance and climate justice or the just transition. And the major thing after they have this overall introduction about the main topics being discussed now on climate change, they will also have this with practitioners, with people that are working on those issues in different organizations, from private sector to governments and NGOs and academia. And after they graduate, they will join the network. So I think that the best part is being able to connect with projects and develop practical things after they graduate from the course.
I'm interested that you say that self-knowledge is a part of the coursework. Can you talk about why you guys do that?
Sure. That's interesting because climate change is very heavy. We see that a lot of young people can get depressed if they don't know how to work all this knowledge, all this grief and anger they feel. So we realized that there was this need to help them in this process, but also because careers are becoming more complex. So if you don't know yourself, you probably will not make a good choice. And that's true for climate change as well. So this combines a little bit about more personal development, but also professional development together. And we have climate circles where they can discuss about their own climate grief. And from the very beginning, we added this self-knowledge component. And people on every survey, they say that it's important to them. And even for our team, I think we learn in the process as well. It's transformative when you discover your community, when you enter into a network that people understand you. They may not agree with everything, and thank God, because we have to discuss and we don't want a uniform network. But they agree with you in the basics, like that we need to fight for justice, the climate change is real, all this common sense that should be common sense, but unfortunately it's not.
I'd like to know more about the folks that have gone through the program. Like, tell me how many have gone through, and then tell me about the goal for how many you have.
Right now, we had 500 people with this new cohort that have been trained by us. And our goal is to reach 1 million by 2030. And by the end of this year, hopefully we'll have like 5,000, so 10 times more than what we are talking right now. And we believe that's important to grow fast because we have this decade to do something serious about. We cannot just like having incremental improvements. But at the same time, the demand is very high. So our major constraint is funding. So we are working on that because we always receive many applications, many emails all the time. We know that young people want to be part of this network. They want to start their climate careers. And also, we, from the very beginning, we decided to give as many scholarships as possible. So an average of 40% of our participants receive some kind of scholarship. And this is very important to increase the diversity of the network. And we have cases from some of them that they said that was for the very first time they realized that they could make their cause their career. So they can see other people similar to them with the same background already getting jobs on climate change, and they will become examples in their communities as well. So that's very important to have this component of giving scholarships, because this make the network diverse, and this is good for everyone, like as we were just talking, that knowing and learning how to work in a diverse environment is important, but also because they will bring this message to their communities as well. And this is something that we want to support.
It must be really exciting that you get to provide that moment to young people where they like figure out like what their purpose is, and they make that connection, and they have that like change in their mindset. But I also imagine maybe it's kind of a process to get to that like aha moment.
This is not an easy journey, because we could be doing other things or earning more money and so forth. But I believe what we receive in turn is like not only the gratitude, and we are enabling people to realize they don't need to choose between being happy and having a career. But I think we are doing this in a way that is not shallow. We are showing that it's difficult, that you have to work for that if you want, but it's possible. Most of young people are somehow anxious about climate change or about COVID-19, and they don't know what to do, and they fear that they will not have a place in this world. We are trying to do our best to show that they can be an agent of this change that we want to build. Together we can build this world that needs to emerge, this world, using the UN jargon, we can build the future we want and the future we deserve. So I think that's a very beautiful path that we are building towards empowering young people and at the same time empowering ourselves in the process.
This question is sort of more at the structural level. And you've talked a little bit about the need to start adopting policy, but if there was one change that you could ask from leadership, and leadership could be defined locally or nationally or internationally, if there were one change that you could ask for, what would you want to see changed in order to tackle this problem?
Having talked to several policymakers during my career, I believe that one thing that they all should do is like to put climate action in the center of their agendas. It's not like a marginal issue anymore for you to like just have pictures and say that you are doing something nice, but you have to plan everything. Even if we stop emissions right now, we will have to deal with the impact of the older emissions. And children should learn skills that will help them to navigate this complex world. You have to plan mobility. Everything should be related to the goal of being carbon neutral by mid-century or even before. So I would change the focus of policies in a way that climate change is our major challenge as humanity, and we have very little time to solve it. So everyone, either if you're a policymaker or if you are starting your career as an intern, you should wake up every day and ask yourself, what can I do? How can I employ my skills into making this transition that we need?
How can I use my skills to make the transition we need? It's a valid question, and Kasi identified two key things. First, self-knowledge. Knowing what your skills are and what you bring to the table, as well as what your weaknesses are, is a great first step towards becoming active in the fight for our future. Like, if you're a strong writer but you hate public speaking, you'd probably be better and more comfortable as a letter writer than you would be testifying at a city council hearing. It helps if you take some time to really evaluate yourself and notice what you're great at and the things you feel like you can do better than the average person. And that's how you see where you can contribute. Once you do that, then it's time for the second thing that Kasia pointed out. That's the transformative power of community. We just feel less alone and less overwhelmed when we work together. It's a simple concept, but so simple that we often take it for granted. Build your own personal network to fight climate change. It doesn't have to be a huge-scale international project like Young Climate Leaders. You can honestly start with something like getting people in your apartment building together to get your building retrofitted for energy efficiency. Or you can work with people at your school to start a composting project. And you can build this network at your job, at your church, with the guys you play basketball with. And there's no such thing as starting too small. The potential for community is everywhere. You just have to be looking for it. Once you find your people and showcase the skills that you bring to the table, then you've already started to make a difference. It's cool to be part of a team. That's why the Lego Movie made a song about it. Because it's always easier when we do it together. There's no denying it.
No Denying It, the UN Climate Action Podcast, is produced by UN News and Good To Do Today. Our producer at UN News is Connor Lennon, and Natalie Hutchison is our promo and distribution manager. Our producers at Good To Do Today are Emma Jacobs, Jay Venables, and Rachel Ward. Our managing producer at UN News is Matthew Wells, and our executive producer is Mita Hosali. Keith Frund and Braden Alexander are our audio engineers, and our theme song is by Memory Palace, courtesy of Marmoset. This episode features music from Artlist. Many, many thanks to Thang Chen, Martina Donlin, Pratishala Jain, Robert Nashovsky, Regina Merkova, June Park, Ezra Sergi, Sam Tracy, Matilda Folino, Freesound.org, and the UN Environment Program. Find more stories about climate action from UN News at news.un.org.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Life-saving aid distributions to millions in Afghanistan have been scaled up, but much more is needed before winter comes, UN humanitarians said on Wednesday. 3 weeks since a major international appeal for funds to help nearly 11 million of the most vulnerable by the end of the year, only around a third of what's required has been received, said UN Humanitarian Coordinating Office OCHA. Supporting the call for urgent assistance, the head of the World Food Programme in Afghanistan, Mary Ellen McGroty, said that Afghanistan was on borrowed time. In my long career with WFP, I've never before seen a crisis unfold at this pace and scale, she said, adding that Afghans faced a new depth of destitution as drought and the economic crisis drives up food and fuel prices. Well before the Taliban takeover on the 15th of August, Afghanistan's humanitarian situation was already one of the worst in the world. According to OCHA, nearly half of the population, some 18.4 million people, needed humanitarian assistance at the start of the year. Conflict and insecurity have displaced nearly 700,000 people so far this year, with more than 3.5 million Afghans uprooted by conflict in total. The number of weekly COVID-19 cases and deaths has continued to decline globally, with over 3 million new cases and just over 54,000 new deaths reported in the last week, according to the World Health Organization. Compared to the previous week, this is a 9% decrease in cases, while deaths remain similar, the WHO said in its weekly epidemiological update. All regions reported a decline in the number of new cases this week, apart from Europe, which remained similar to the week before. The largest decrease in new weekly cases was reported in Africa, followed by the Eastern Mediterranean, Southeast Asia, the Americas, and the Western Pacific. The number of confirmed cases reported globally is now over 234 million, and deaths are just under 4.8 million. A full commitment to achieving peace in Yemen remains crucially important, the new UN Special Envoy to the country has said on his first visit there. Hans Grundberg met with Prime Minister Maim Abdulmak Said in the interim capital Aden on Tuesday. They discussed political developments and the significance of the Riyadh Agreement for achieving stability, delivering basic services, and securing the economy, the UN mission in Yemen said in a tweet. The Riyadh Agreement, signed in November 2019, ended the fighting between forces loyal to the Yemen government and southern separatists. Mr. Grunberg also met with Aidarus al-Zubaydi, head of the Southern Transitional Council, his office said. The UN envoy's visit comes amid an escalation in fighting around the northern city of Marib, which mainly Houthi opposition forces have been trying for months to capture from government forces. On Sunday, reported missile strikes in central Marib left 2 children dead and 24 people injured. A day earlier in Aden, 4 non-combatants died, including one child. Katie Dartford, UN News.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Floods, droughts and other water-related hazards have increased because of climate change, the UN warned on Tuesday in an appeal for better management, monitoring and forecasting of the dangers. According to a new report from the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, and partner agencies, 1 in 3 people in the world has already been exposed to major water stress, and this number is expected to soar. Early warning systems are fragmented and inadequate, WMO said, adding that global climate finance efforts to improve the situation have been insufficient. In Geneva, WMO Secretary General Petteri Tallas told journalists that climate change has been responsible for the 7% increase in global humidity levels. This has fueled devastating rainfall, particularly across Asia.
Asia has been the continent which has been mostly exposed to both the deaths and the economic losses related to the flooding, and it's very much river flooding that we are talking about here.
Apart from extreme rainfall that has caused massive flooding in Japan, China, Indonesia, Nepal, Pakistan and India, displacing millions in the past year, wealthy nations in Europe have also been hit by catastrophic flooding, which led to hundreds of deaths and widespread damage in Germany, France and Belgium. In Africa, the lack of water continues to be a major cause of concern, WMO's Professor Tallas said, with more than 2 billion people living in water-stressed countries where there's a lack of access to safe drinking water and sanitation. In northern Mozambique, worrying reports have emerged that children as young as 5 have been shown how to handle weapons and indoctrinated to fight with insurgents. The warning on Tuesday from UN Children's Fund UNICEF came as aid access improved to previously inaccessible areas in Cabo Delgado province that were occupied by Al-Shabaab militia. When fighting broke out in March, humanitarian access to the district was completely blocked, and to tens of thousands of displaced people, including those who fled the coastal town of Palma. It was only very recently that UNICEF and partners managed to deliver hygiene kits, water purification tablets, food and shelter to the displaced population in Palma with the help of the Mozambican authorities. Here's the agency's spokesperson in Geneva, James Elder.
Unverified video material secured by armed forces in an abandoned training camp apparently shows abducted children, some as young as 5, handling weapons and being indoctrinated to fight. Other recent reports show young boys and girls who are abducted from their families and videos, and these are matching accounts that family members have told UNICEF and our partners. This unfortunately is leaving very little doubt that children are being forcibly recruited by this non-state armed group.
There have been so many storms in the Atlantic Ocean so far this year that the usual list of names given to them could well be exhausted, UN weather experts said on Tuesday. The development follows 2020's record-breaking hurricane season, which saw 30 named tropical storms, including 9 names from the Greek alphabet. The devastating storms Eta and Iota were among them. With 2 weeks remaining of the current storm season, Hurricane Sam has been churning away in the North Atlantic and causing big swells, but it is not really a threat to the land, according to the World Meteorological Organization, WMO. Relatively few storms have made landfall this season, with the exception of Hurricane Ida, the deadliest and most damaging of the year, and Hurricane Grace in mid-August that affected the Caribbean. Here's WMO spokesperson Claire Nullis.
The Atlantic season in 2021 has been so active that we are on the verge of exhausting the regular list. We've just got to Victor, who's now dissipated without ever becoming a threat. The final name on the list is Wanda, which at the moment shows no signs of forming, but you know, we still have a few more weeks to the end of the hurricane season.
If new names are needed before this year's Atlantic storm season ends, Ms. Nullis explained that a WMO hurricane committee had decided that Greek letters should not be used, but rather a supplementary list. The first name on that list is Adria, Ms. Nullis explained. Daniel Johnson. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Least developed countries have invested around 14 times less in their post-COVID economic recovery than richer nations, who could do far more to help them balance out growing inequalities, UN Chief Antonio Guterres said on Monday. Addressing the UNCTAD 15 high-level virtual meeting on trade and development, Mr. Guterres told delegates that the world's pandemic recovery was moving in the wrong direction. With millions of jobs lost and social safety nets out of reach to many, the UN Secretary General reminded delegates that 120 million people fell into poverty last year. A further 811 million are going hungry today, he added, while decades of hard-won development progress are slipping away too. To turn this around, Mr. Guterres urged those gathered in Barbados and remotely to tackle four key challenges to sustainable and inclusive development. These included debt distress that left poorer countries crippled because they had to service foreign loans, and which the UN chief suggested could be fixed by creating greater liquidity and extending their debt relief payments. Bold investments are also needed in education, social protection, healthcare and decent work at the community level, Mr. Guterres said, as are fair trade rules and modernizing investment to help the poorest nations reduce costs that made them uncompetitive. The final challenge for developing countries will be to ensure their green transition away from carbon-heavy economies to green energy sources, the Secretary General continued. War crimes and crimes against humanity have likely been committed in Libya by all parties to the conflict since 2016, including external actors, a Human Rights Council-appointed probe said on Monday. From arbitrary detention to torture, the recruitment of child soldiers and mass killings, the independent fact-finding mission on Libya listed numerous grave rights violations which had impacted on the country's people. Civilians were particularly at risk during the 2019 to 2020 fight for Tripoli, the mission said, as well as during other armed confrontations in the country since 2016. The investigators published their findings after interviewing more than 150 individuals alongside parallel research in Libya, Tunisia and Italy. Here's the mission's Tracy Robinson speaking to journalists in Geneva.
Arbitrary detention in secret prisons and unbearable conditions of detention are widely used by the state and militias against anyone perceived to be a threat to their interests or views. Violence in Libyan prisons is committed on such a scale and with such a level of organization that it may also potentially amount to crimes against humanity.
Mission member Chiloki Biyani also pointed to the continued presence of foreign fighters in the country from the Syrian conflict, allegedly contracted by the Russian-based Wagner Group. The deaths of youngsters and adults in Yemen over the weekend has been condemned by the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF. This follows reported missile strikes in central Marib city on Sunday, which left two children dead and 24 people injured. A day earlier, in the southern city of Aden, four non-combatants died, including one child. In a statement, Ted Shaban, UNICEF Regional Director for the Middle East and North Africa, said that since fighting escalated in 2015, nearly 10,000 children have been confirmed killed or injured. The development follows a reported uptick in conflict and violent riots sparked by economic collapse and poor public services. Daniel Johnson, UN News.